Hello, this is Pam with broadcast number 4 of the book 90 Years with Dogs by Dorothy M. Norris. Last time, we continued with Dorothy being in Canada. After 3 years at the island school, Dorothy moved to a small town of Albert, Alberta, and taught there. Sam went with her, and when mice proved to be a problem, she also acquired a cat named Gypsy Bella. Sam and the cat were great friends. When Dorothy retired from teaching, she returned to Vancouver and purchased a home there. At age 14 and a half, Sam finally passed away, and the cat passed shortly after. Dorothy was busy with her life and with volunteer activities and had kind of thought about not getting a dog, but a friend convinced her to go when they were going to kill a bunch of dogs, and so she went there and was able to rescue one, which she named Abarissa. Strangely, I have limited memories of the few years that I cared for this little dog. I do not think we established any real bond, despite the companionship of having an animal living in the house. Her well-being, happiness, and safety were important. But she seemed as happy in the kennels I had used for years when I went away for a holiday as she did on my return. I cannot recall any excited greeting when I came home, but my memory could be at fault here. Less remote than in either of my previous Canadian homes, it was easier for more relatives to visit me in Duncan. Nieces and nephews and their own children came by, and I had the pleasure of watching another generation exploring opportunities. It was a comfort as my children and 4 grandchildren already were growing up far away in London and Spain, although I have very happy memories of lovely holidays when my son and 2 daughters each visited at different times. So did a granddaughter who came with a friend, and we all went for a flight with one of my nephews as a pilot. No one had followed me permanently to Canada as I had hoped, even though in my remote float house years before, I'd even furnished a room in the hope that they would come and stay. It was a time when I lost a number of friends. Many were expats who had moved to Canada in the early 1950s and were considerably older than myself. But each loss, particularly within the groups of regular visitors, was sad and unsettling. Something we all experience as we age. The greatest loss of all was that of my elder brother. We had developed a deep friendship, which had somewhat made up for the many years we had been separated in the earlier part of our lives. A strong motivation in my returning to Canada in 1980 was a deep desire to get to know my brothers better, and although the time I had been granted with the younger of the two had been prematurely cut short, I had been blessed with love and friendship of my older sibling and the times we had together. In the spring of 2000, shortly before I joined my youngest daughter and her husband for a holiday, I had been approached by the real estate agent who had originally dealt with my purchase of the house. At his suggestion, it was arranged that in my absence, he should hold an open day to gauge the value and interest in the property should I ever decide to move. With Abarissa safely in kennels, I went away and thought little more about it, knowing I could trust him. I was curious about how much my home had appreciated in value during my time living in Duncan. The valuation and, after my return from holiday, an even more advantageous offer led to a rapid chain of events that I had never imagined. During the preceding 20 years, and particularly since the loss of Sam and Gypsy Bella, I must admit, I had weighed up the pros and cons of returning to the United Kingdom, where my youngest daughter and husband still lived. It was a hastily made decision, with all the consequences of such a relocation for my Canadian friends and relatives. Once focused on returning to England, Abarissa was my only real problem. I never considered taking her with me to face the months of expensive quarantine that such an action would have necessitated. The only criticism I ever received for leaving the little dog was from her new owner, a friend of a friend, who knew nothing of her background or mine and took her on at face value. with more freedom than I had ever been able to provide, and as an owner with a large property and car, I sensed that Aberisa would have a happy and relatively long life ahead of her. My years in Canada were over. Chapter 15, Walking English Country Lanes Again. In the summer of 2000, I found myself moving into a new home, this time in Yorkshire. Yet again, all my things traveled through the Panama Ship Canal and across the Atlantic. With a beautiful view of the hills and dales on the edge of the Peak National Park, my new little house was within walking distance of my daughter, Heather, and her husband's property and my latest granddaughter. All I needed was a dog. For now, I knew I was at last mentally ready to welcome a four-legged companion who I hoped would become a friend. We found her at a local RSPA rescue center, and I knew from the moment I saw her, she would be both lovable and loving. There was a collie, perhaps Sheltie, in her genes. Ginger was brown and white in color. She was a medium-sized dog with a lovely silk plume of a tail which she carried proudly, and soft, tufted ears and a ruff of hair framing her face. She needed a lot of grooming, but she still left long, silken hairs around the house, a small price to pay for her affectionate presence. She had been estimated at 15 weeks old when abandoned in the heart of Halifax, left tied to a bollard in the middle of a road. Microchips were still in their infancy at the beginning of the new millennium, so her owners were untraceable. Her terrifying experience gave her a lasting fear of heavy traffic, particularly motorbikes. Fortunately, she enjoyed traveling by car and always responded to an outing with pleasure. Within weeks of my arrival, and after being approved as a suitable owner, we took her home at the height of the blackberry season. I named her Bramble. Those early months are a bit of a blur now, as I was busy with unpacking and trying to fit the contents of a much larger Canadian home into an English semi-detached house. There was a difference in culture, too, as I now, an incomer, viewed with suspicion. In Canada, I had become accustomed to getting to know strangers over a cup of coffee, and it would take several years before I fully accepted that people in Yorkshire did not drop in to have a cuppa in order to get acquainted. My daily walks with Bramble, however, soon provided a very diverse number of acquaintances as we explored the neighborhood. Dog walkers were willing to say hello. We kept the roads at first, as I had been away too long to lose an instinctive fear of something lurking behind the trees or dry stone walls. Soon we began to explore bridle tracks and pathways up onto the surrounding moorland. There were other walkers enjoying the scenery as they exercised their dogs, and even when they were lost in thought or enjoying their own company, their dogs had a different approach. Immediately alert to another four-legged stranger in the vicinity, they knew whether it was friend or foe. Bramble soon made two very different friends as their walks coincided with ours. One was a Jack Russell and the other an Irish wolfhound, and while the dogs communicated, we owners talked and I began to learn about the locality. There would be many more dogs over the years who came and went, but I think these first friends were the most important in Bramble's life, helping her to establish her place in the local canine society. She enjoyed going out, but I had to hold her close and reassure her when I heard the distant sound of an approaching motorbike. The only other hazard was the milk tanker that still made daily collections from the few remaining local dairy farms. Its timing varied, but the size, bulk, and engine frightened Bramble to such an extent that I would scan the hillsides daily to see where it parked, whether it looked stationary, or the direction it was taking. I could see for miles from our upland walks, and over time, if the tanker unexpectedly approached us from behind, I gained local knowledge of where the nearest four-barred field gate might be found. They provided a deeper and safer recess for her than the narrow verges and high, dry stone walls that bordered most of our local roads around my new Yorkshire home. Bramble seemed to like the dairy cattle in the local fields, and over several summers she established an acquaintance through the bars of one gate with two cows. They approached out of curiosity at first, But the daily nose-to-nose encounter seemed to have some significance, and Bramble always appeared puzzled when she found the empty field due to a temporary change of grazing. She was unfazed by the movement of sheep or even a runaway horse we once encountered, but we were both unprepared for a carload of dogs. We were returning from a tranquil walk on the moor. The track led directly to where our lane made an abrupt right-angle turn close to a patch of waste ground where cars occasionally parked. I had barely noticed the approach of a small car until it stopped and the owner got out. Opening both side and rear doors, the woman released at least 5 dogs who headed straight for us and the track. They seemed to be dogs of all sizes, and I was never certain whether there were some little ones between the whirl of legs and excited barks and yaps that suddenly filled the silence. My immediate reaction was to freeze. Past memories of being knocked down by a pack of feral dogs attacking Sam flooding my thoughts. I had already put Bramble back on her lead before we approached the road, and I found she was cowering beside me. When I discovered my wits, I realized the dogs had passed us by, intent on their temporary freedom. That sudden encounter shocked me. I had not come across paid dog walkers taking out numerous dogs before. Perhaps it had emerged during my years in Canada? From then on, the occasional sight of anything resembling that little car and its possible occupants made me change our route for the day. I saw the dogs several times that year from a safe distance before their routine changed or they moved away. Bramble shared many family outings, enjoying the thrill of new places, sniffing out new smells, or trying to chase squirrels and birds just for the fun of making them run or fly away. My daughter took her for many walks, too, enjoying the exercise and some relaxation. Bramble just enjoyed life and spent as much time in my garden as I did, exploring and returning to see what I was doing from time to time. During holiday times, we would enjoy house visiting, too. She and I would spend time on a property that became home from home, and she soon learned how far she could safely explore before returning to my side. Bramble had a loving, friendly, and gentle personality so that she just accepted the somewhat unpredictable behavior of my latest 2 small grandchildren, retiring to her basket in the corner of the dining room when they visited. As they got older, she submitted to being led around the house as if she was a toy, accompanied by 1 or 2 of their own toy dogs on makeshift leads. She never protested, but I finally had to put a stop to this. Later on, they would take turns preparing her food while she used to stand on her hind legs and bouncing in a series of little jumps while her bowl was filled. It was an enduring habit and a daily mealtime ritual that never failed to bring delight. Bramble had the same gentle approach to my daughter's cat, Pushkin. For some considerable time when we were visiting, Pushkin viewed Bramble from the safety of their staircase. But I was delighted when cat and dog finally met at floor level. When I saw him rub his head against Bramble's neck, I knew that he had at last accepted her as part of his family. Bramble had very keen hearing and heard the slightest unusual sound outside his own home, alerting me to the approach of strangers, which I found invaluable. While some dogs react with growls or a frenzied barking, she stood or sat listening intently, with her head a little to one side, indicating the direction from which the noise had come. Unfortunately for her, this sensitivity had an adverse effect as each firework season approached. Having lived for so many years overseas, where fireworks were only used in mass displays to celebrate a special occasion, I had forgotten the indiscriminate way fireworks are often used in the United Kingdom. A fireworks company was based not far from my new home, providing jobs and perhaps even discounted sales. This ready supply may explain why loud bangs and whistles occurred not only the days before the 5th of November, but for some time later. With their ever-growing power and noise, the explosions seemed devised to give some people's hearts an unpleasant jolt. Fireworks terrify many animals, and Bramble was no exception. Whether it was something that whirled or whistled around the walls or rooftop, clattered like an anti-aircraft gun, or sounded powerful enough to make the windows cave in, There was nowhere she could hide. Turning up the volume of a radio or television never helped, and it was annually something she, like many dogs and other animals, have to suffer. Having watched the deer and disorientation of animals I love dearly, I failed to understand why there is no legislation to control the indiscriminate use of fireworks. I believe that fireworks use condones cruelty, and tranquilizers are not the answer when the random detonations and the resultant fear may become lifelong. Bramble loved toys. She was given several squeaky toys, but they did not last long. I discouraged them as gifts when I discovered the squeak inside was just wrapped in a plastic bag and was dangerously small. She had always been intrigued at the area of the toy where the squeak was emitted, and her attempts to locate it were often too successful for my peace of mind. Another favorite toy was a doorstop, which closely resembled a rather lovable puppy and was often playfully purloined by the children. I often found it in her basket after their visits, but was never quite certain who had put it there, as it was used for an upstairs door and was rather heavy to be dragged downstairs unseen or unheard. One popular toy was a solid, many-sided red ball with built-in cavities, which made it easier for her to grip. It was too big for any danger of swallowing, but small enough to roll under furniture, which kept Bramble busy for long periods as she investigated its position from all angles and tried to work out how to retrieve it. Her delight when it was returned to her was very enjoyable to watch. Bramble's collection also included a solid rubber yellow bone. She took it to her basket at night, and it was invariably close to her during the day, except for the few occasions when she hid it and played with something else. I sometimes came across it, perhaps in a remote corner or under a cushion, the latter a place where one might not expect to find it, as she preferred her basket to a chair and never played on the furniture. If I left it in place, she knew exactly where it was and would re-find it with great excitement, as if she had made a new discovery. It was part of her many enduring qualities that made her so beloved by everyone who knew her. It was Easter 2011, a time of year when Bramble and I had lovely long walks and also spent a lot of time on my daughter and family's property when they were away visiting friends in Italy. When I went downstairs one morning, instead of being greeted by the excitement of another new day, I found Bramble lying quietly in her basket. I could not see anything wrong, and she did not seem to be in any pain anywhere. She just did not want to move. Of more concern was that she did not want anything to eat or drink. Without transport of my own and living some considerable distance from a vet, I hesitated before telephoning them for advice, knowing that the morning was their busiest time. As I expected, they could not arrange a visit until late afternoon, during which time I sat on the floor beside Bramble, comforting her and hoping she would show some improvement. The vet came with an assistant, and having made a cursory examination, told me she was very weak, which of course I knew. He then asked me somewhat abruptly if I had pet insurance, to which I said no. It so happened that for the first time in my life with dogs, I had taken out an insurance in her early years, purely because it was a novelty to me and a cheap offer which I could afford. I had not come across pet insurances before. I had kept up the premiums for some years, but had become disconcerted by the scale of the annual increase. When I questioned this, I was told that with every year my pet was getting older and the likelihood of illness was greater. How true, but I had lived through a different era where a no claim had been annually rewarded with a bonus. My dogs had always lived long and healthy lives. I had finally discontinued the insurance. In the event, I do not think in Bramble's case it would have made any difference, except to my financial liability. Not satisfied with the results of the examination, the vet said that he needed an x-ray and more tests back at the surgery. They departed with my precious dog, promising to telephone me as soon as possible. I cannot recall even having a moment to say goodbye. Certainly, I had no idea I would not see her again. Poor little Bramble. When the call came, I was told she had a ruptured spleen, presumably a genetic weakness, as nothing had occurred in her life to have caused it, and they could not save her. the news was devastating. With my nearest family members away, I had no means of bringing her home for interment close to other family pets who had been buried in the wood she had so loved. I had the consolation of phone calls, particularly from my son Jeremy in Spain, and also a call from Italy, but it was a particularly difficult time. I could not help comparing the sympathy I had received when Sam and Gypsy Bella had died in Canada to just receiving an invoice from the veterinary practice a few days later for the care I am sure they had given my much-loved dog. Some days later, I received a letter from an old school friend in the United States with whom I had shared my grief. She enclosed a memorial card which reads as followed. In loving memory of Jenny and Bramble, who never met each other, but were both very much loved and best of companions and important parts of the lives of the Grange family of New Paltz, New York, and Dorothy, an old and dear school friend living in Yorkshire, UK. Jenny and Bramble, you will always be missed, and I know that you will be best friends at Angel's Rest, the other side of the Rainbow Bridge. Angel Rest is a memorial garden. Receiving this at that particular moment in time meant a lot to me and helped to fill the void Bramble had left. Chapter 16, Another Faithful Friend. With advancing years, the idea of having another pet is perhaps foolish, but when living alone, the practicalities of such thoughts are not fully considered. On their return from holiday, my younger daughter and family had been as saddened by my loss of Bramble as other family members. I recall my granddaughter suggesting a variety of possible new companions for me, ranging from a cat and a parrot to a chihuahua. Knowing that the usual channels for rehoming a dog with an older person would be out of the question, they and their parents turned to the internet. Different charities were contacted, and in a very short time, Leo arrived. Leo was brought by van from a considerable distance. He was an undernourished stray who we were told could not be housed by the nearest rescue center as it was already full, and he was being temporarily housed by another charity equally stretched for accommodation. The lady asked few questions, checked that the garden was well fenced, assured us that he was a good traveler, accepted a donation, and left the trembling dog in my care. Leo, the name given on the health check and record book, had been substituted for another name, and the description had been altered to a crossbreed, an untreated black whippet with white points. I did not look at it until after she had left, as there were things I should have questioned, but my thoughts were on the dog. He had the appearance of a small greyhound, but brought back memories of another black, long-legged dog of a different breed some 50 years previously, also shivering with fear of the unknown, his large eyes imploringly seeking someone to trust and love and be loved in return. I knew immediately that Leo, like Sebastian of long ago, would need much love and reassurance in the years to come. I was shocked to find that my new dog was not house-trained. At first, I put this down to nerves, as he was a very frightened dog. Left briefly on his own, Leo tried to escape through the bay window, almost emptying the bookcase in front of it in his attempt to reach the spacious windowsill. I found the heavy volume scattered on my return, fortunately undamaged. Another attempt to restrain him in the kitchen resulted in his pulling his head out of his collar, something I did not repeat. However, he regarded the entire kitchen floor as a cat might regard a litter tray, which was fortunate for the rest of the house. But just one of Leo's problems through no fault of his own. A vet put my new companion's age at 8 or more years. He thought Leo had been living by his wits for some considerable time and would soon be restored to health. He said that at some time there had been an injury to a front leg and pointed out that the dog had lost part of an ear. I soon found that, contrary to what I had been told, he was not a good traveler, and any journey by car made him sick. Tablets from the vet did not help, and though we tried several times, it did restrict any journey or outing by car with my grandchildren. Fortunately, he walked well on a lead, and the only time he needed a strong arm was the odd occasions when a squirrel or cat crossed the road or when there was a sudden crack from a firework. It was far safer to miss our afternoon walk as the days around November 5th were a terrifying ordeal for him and difficult for me. He had very acute hearing and picked up the distant bangs well before I heard a crack, fizzle, or whine locally. My knowledge of greyhounds was very limited, and as with any new dog, new knowledge comes with every passing day. Gradually, their different characters, intelligence levels, and behavior patterns are revealed, while at the same time, affection, trust, and understanding grow on both sides. My knowledge, depth of feeling, and love were considerably enhanced when a leaking pipe and structural damage brought builders and a couple of mature cleaners into our home. The women took an immediate interest in my dog. Leo liked to know what was going on and silently watched from a safe distance, often around a corner where he could easily back out of sight. He seldom trusted people enough to approach them, but accepted women more easily than men. The cleaners wanted to know all about him. They noted his damaged ear and told me it was probably where a registration number had been torn off before he was abandoned, so the owner could not be traced. The thought of Leo being mutilated in such a way was horrendous. I learned that some people kept his breed in wire cages, often in kitchens, and used them just for racing or hair coursing to make money. Once they ceased to be winners, they were discarded. I hoped such stories were exaggerated, but a few months later, a chance conversation with a regular delivery man confirmed what they had said. He, too, was interested when he first saw Leo and told me that his brother had two similar dogs, kept caged when not working. Some visits later, he mentioned that his brother had won a substantial sum with the dogs. The next time I asked about the dogs, he said that his brother had only one now, as the other had proved useless. I never mentioned them again. Leo had no interest in toys. He spent much of his time in the house, sleeping, and chose an old armchair for his bed with his head hanging down to the floor or resting over one arm with his long nose pointing to the ceiling. Uncomfortable positions, but he liked it that way. Whenever I left a room, he followed me, standing quietly watching until my task was completed. It was the same in the garden. I think my enjoyment of gardening was a complete mystery to him, and he refused to enter the greenhouse, even when there was sudden rain. As he hated getting wet, he had some fear, perhaps, of the limited space, although he chose the nearby paved area as a permanent place to relieve himself. He never asked to go out when we were in the house, so I had to establish a routine. This worked well. He liked routines, and when he went into the garden on his own, he always followed the same tracks that he had gradually formed through and around the trees and shrubs in preference to the paths I had established. Many animals have remarkable memories, including recognition of human communication through both sound and sign language. I recall when I was a child teaching our dogs commands in schoolgirl French, which they soon accepted as easily as English. We even tried German, but this was frowned upon by family, and our experiment soon lost our interest. Dogs have the ability to pick out certain meaningful words in conversation which have been deliberately altered to mislead them. They appear to recognize complete phrases and will listen intently when someone talks to them when time is spent with just one person. In particular, they remember individual names, which perhaps they associate with a family member with whom they temporarily bonded on a visit. Leo knew the names of all my immediate family, and whenever I received overseas telephone calls, I told him the name of the caller. Sometimes they spoke to him, and he showed recognition of the voice with varying degrees of pleasure, though what he made of it can only be guessed. On their infrequent visits, he just accepted their presence as if there had not been many months since he last saw them. Although with children, it took longer for full acceptance, perhaps because of the change in their size. Leo's one and only visit to kennels took place about 2 years after he had joined me. I had to have a hip replacement, and although my time away from home would be brief, his occasional nocturnal visits to the kitchen made it impossible for him to stay with my daughter and her family, as they had a dog of their own by now. It must have been yet another terrifying experience for him, though he had the best possible care and understanding. My son, Jeremy, flew in from Spain to care for us both temporarily on my discharge from hospital. He had two old English sheepdogs of his own at the time and shared memories of most of my former four-legged companions. Leo was familiar with his voice over the phone and was very happy to be back home with us both until I could cope safely on my own. I found it become necessary to get help with cleaning, but there seemed to be a constant staffing problem, people not turning up due to illness or perhaps the non-arrival of a child minder. On one occasion, the young owner of the cleaning company asked her mother to cover for an absentee. The mother took an immediate interest in Leo. She had an elderly dog, too, and she offered to take Leo for daily walks with her own. At the time, I imagine neither of us considered how long this arrangement would last. I thought of it as a temporary measure, as I still hoped to regain full mobility, but Leo had found new friends. A lady in whom he had complete trust, and a small Heinz variety rescue dog with a similarly sad background. When they first met, they seemed to establish an immediate bond. Tiny, so aptly named, reached less than halfway up Leo's long legs and stood quietly while Leo checked him out and found the smell safe and satisfactory. Tiny was a complete contrast to Leo, with multicolored long hair and an immediate, trusting, friendly nature. The two dogs liked each other, and Tiny accepted me from the moment we met on the back doorstep. It was an unexpected friendship that was to continue for years. The consideration for my well-being and that of my dog extended through three generations of the same family, and they made sure that if one person was not available to take Leo for his walk, some other member of the family collected Leo regardless of the very changeable Yorkshire weather. When Tiny succumbed to old age, Leo's daily outings continued, and I believe his presence in the moorland areas, enjoyed by both dogs for so long, also helped the dog walkers' grief at the loss of their own little companion. In due course, another rescued dog joined the daily walk, but Leo showed no interest in the new companion. The feeling was apparently mutual. The dogs seemed to ignore each other from their first meeting. I found this interesting, as Leo had established a good relationship with a dog now owned by another member of the same family, and although they met very infrequently, Harley and he became good friends, showing pleasure each time they met. Leo began to show his age sometime before I had to face the inevitability of losing him. Several inexplicable illnesses occurred, variously treated, from which he rallied, recovered, and was ready for his walks again. Sometimes he walked very slowly, and his walkers gave me frequent health reports. But at times he showed his old energy and was laughingly dubbed the dog with nine lives. Apart from his walks, he liked to keep me within view, even when I went into the garden or up and down the stairs, which I think he found difficult at times. He alone among all my dogs did not decide that the time had come to leave stairs to others. And one morning there was a sudden crash, and I found him at the bottom, seemingly unconscious, amid the debris of a table of cacti which he had knocked over. There was little a vet could do, and a few days later, before Christmas 2019, we had to say goodbye. He was laid to rest close to other much-loved pets in our family wood, the place where he had finally found peace and happiness in a very long life. Leo would be the last of my wonderful lifetime companions. What love they have given me and what joy and friendship they have shared. Their memories will live on. This is the end of Dorothy M. Morris's 90 Years with Dogs. I have a few short stories to fill up our time before the hour is up. This story is from October 28, 2023, written by Naman Zhu, and it is from the New Yorker magazine. My Grandmother and the Canine Detective. How the Austrian Police Procedure Inspector Rex Bridges Gaps Between Languages. My grandmother, who is 92, has moved three times in her life. She was born in a small town in the province of Shandong, China, and when she was 23, she took a boat to Shanghai. When she was 63, she moved to Sydney, Australia, where I was born, and then, when she was 85, came with me and my mother to New York. There are a few similarities across the places. All three are port cities, populous, but not the capital, that grew fat off the trade of the eastern coast. Another constant in her life, at least in the past 20 years or so, has been the Australian police procedural television show, Inspector Rex, which is about a crime-fighting dog. Rex debuted in 1994, the year I was born, and ran for 18 seasons over the course of 21 years. A standard episode takes 45 minutes and follows the titular dog, Rex, who is part of a crack homicide unit in Vienna. The show was originally filmed in German. Rex's colleagues include a lead detective, who changes every three or four seasons, an earnest deputy, and a bumbling third guy who stays at the station. Supposedly a family program, the show blends an earnest 90s sensibility. There is a running joke in which Rex finds new ways to steal ham rolls from one of the lesser detectives with an occasionally macabre flourish. People are killed with poisons, stabbed, thrown from the balcony of a museum, hit over the head with a large wrench. In one typical episode, the lead detective, Mosier, investigates a murder in which a woman has been hypnotized into stabbing her boyfriend. As the villain is about to kill Mosier with a motorbike, Rex launches out of a bush and attacks him. My grandmother is a big fan of the show, and many people around the world evidently share her disposition. It was immensely popular in its native Austria and Germany, across Europe, and in Australia, where it ran during prime time on the Special Broadcasting Service, a government-funded multicultural broadcaster. When Rex was canceled by its Australian channel after 10 years in 2004, the Italian national broadcaster, RAI, bought the rights and moved Rex to Rome. Such was the nation's love for the dog. From the streets of Vienna, he now frolicked along the Fountain of Neptune in the Piazza Navona with a handsome new Italian human partner named Fabri. The show also been made in Poland, Commissar Alex, Portugal, Inspector Max, Lithuania, Inspectorius Maslis, Slovakia, Rex, and Canada, Hudson and Rex. This level of intercontinental popularity can be attributed to two factors. One is the show's reliable villain of the week structure. The second is its star, a stately German shepherd who is clearly and visibly intelligent in a way that transcends language. My school years in Australia coincided with a kind of Rex mania. I remembered news stories about how pet owners would put the show on for their dogs, who would bark and gleefully wag their tails at the screen. Pope Benedict XIV, who was German, was reportedly a fan and watched it with his brother Georg, who claimed to be friends with a man from the Bavarian city of Regensburg, who owned one of the dogs that played Rex. We didn't have a dog. In our house, the show was for my grandmother and for me. My mother raised me alone and sometimes worked late. Looking after me became my grandmother's responsibility, and in a way, vice versa. Many nights we would watch Rex together while we waited for my mother to come home. For an elderly woman originally from Shandong, then naturalized in Shanghai, a mostly kinetic show in German about a charismatic, industrious dog was perfect. Unlike me, she couldn't read the English subtitles. But nobody was under any illusion that that mattered. In Rex, my grandmother and I had a being of pure legibility, one who wordlessly told us exactly what he was doing. The plot, of course, was finagled so that each case could be solved by something a dog could do. My grandmother watched with a rather flat affect. The human sparked very little reaction from her, but when the dog appeared, she would always point and make sure I was watching, and remark to me or herself about how smart dogs are. There was a phrase we like to say to each other when we watch Inspector Rex. It's a construction of Shanghainese, whose elegance and full power can only be glimpsingly translated into English. It's four words, or more accurately, characters, written in simplified Chinese, and they give an example, transcribed phonetically in our accent, it's something like Gu Zhe Le Li. Literally, it means the dog has come out. Parsed into more fluid English, you'd say, the dog is here, or more perfectly, something like, there he is. When people would consider the default language of China, standard Chinese, which English speakers colloquially call Mandarin, was only made official in the 1950s. Standard Chinese is based on Mandarin, but the two are not the same. Shanghainese, which is the language that my family speaks at home, is often called a dialect. There is a common misconception that Mandarin and Cantonese are the only two stars in the Chinese language, and that all people speak one or the other. But the history of China is really that of hundreds of languages. Shanghainese and other regional dialects like Fujianese, Hokkien, and Hunanese are hundreds of years old, have millions of speakers, and developed independently of, and even before standard Chinese, which is based on the dialect of northern China, where Beijing is situated. Linguists have tried to draw hard boundaries around what is and isn't a dialect, but nobody can. Looking at the constituent parts, speech, intelligibility, many dialects have the same level of similarity or difference with one another as languages do. In 1945, the social linguist Max Weinreich popularized the saying that a language is a dialect with an army and a navy, which is to say, a dialect becomes a language when it is spoken by the people in power. During the Qing dynasty, which lasted shockingly until 1911, the imperial language of China was Manchu, a now endangered language from a region in the northeast that overlaps with modern-day Russia. Cantonese, from the city of Guangzhou on the Pearl River Delta in China's south, was in many ways the dominant language of the early years of global commerce and the first stages of migration into China. Now in mainland China, standard Chinese reigns through the hard mechanism of the modern Chinese state post-1949 when Beijing was remade the capital, and its local accent rolled out across the country. Shanghainese, which is part of the Wu language group, originated near the Yangtze River, is thousands of years old. Wu Chinese has about 80 million native speakers, more than Italian and almost as many as German, making it one of the most spoken native languages in the world. It's common for people in China to still speak their local language with family and friends, but to learn standard Chinese at school, hear it on TV, and speak it at work. Satellite TV channels in China are banned, by law, from broadcasting in local dialects. Ethnic minorities, including the Uyghurs, are made to learn standard Chinese. In Hong Kong, Cantonese has become a de facto language of protest, especially during the 2019 pro-democracy demonstrations. Neither Shanghainese nor standard Chinese is my grandmother's original language. She grew up speaking the Shandong dialect. But in our family, we have always spoken to one another in Shanghainese, which is my mother's first language, the bridge. My grandmother learned it when she moved to Shanghai as a young woman. I learned it as a child in Sydney. This is undoubtedly a case of confirmation bias, but I find it wonderfully easy to speak. It is slangy and pliable, lacks as rigid a tone structure as other Chinese languages, and has sounds that are forgiving and easy to make. There is a Chinese idiom about how soft Shanghainese sounds in the ear. People call it the tender speech of Wu. Sometimes, to me, it sounds more similar to Korean than standard Chinese. The Korean island of Jeju is only 300 miles away. Lower open vowels are rapid firing of soft consonants. Many people my grandmother's age and older struggle to speak standard Chinese. The countrywide push to make it the national language only happened midway through the 20th century, later than the country's adoption of the radio. My grandmother can, but does so with an intense northern accent, which is a lot of younger Chinese-born people makes it impenetrable. She was on the phone recently with a health insurance company. They patched a translator onto the line, but something as simple as her address sounds so heavily different that the translator couldn't understand. I'm sorry, she has a very strong accent, the translator said to the phone operator. My mother and I have to keep reminding my grandmother to speak Putonggua, the Chinese name for standard Chinese, which means the common tongue. To say that in English, there he is good, but still incomplete. The emergence of this Austrian and later Italian dog lives to me in Shanghainese. Translators butt up against this problem all the time, how to replicate the elegance of a phrase in one language to another. In Shanghainese, the fact that gu, dog, comes first is perfect. Articles are rarely used in Chinese. Linguistically, gu tse le li replicates the sensation of how gu tse le li. That u sounds to me like the first second of a bark. The dog is there sticking his nose out before the verb, the preposition. And tse le li, too, is a figurative coming out, nothing ever as stodgy as he has emerged. Chinese verbs do not have tenses, let alone the past perfect. What is he coming out from? It's a bit metaphysical. The dog is emerging from the absence of dog. It's like what you'd say when the curtain rises and the dancers pour out, something more like voila. I love this. The things formed in the unique nooks of a language. It's not like the word for dog or come out don't exist in English. It's that the grammar itself or the rules of word order don't let you express it to the same effect. Roland Keltz once noted in this magazine on the difficulty of translating Haruki Murakami that Japanese frequently allows for sentences not to have subjects, giving many of Murakami's lines a wonderful vagueness that is crushed in English. Virginia Woolf once wrote that it is useless to read Greek in translation because we can never hope to get the whole fling of a sentence the same. There are other blunt, beautiful phrases my grandmother says to me in Shanghainese that are hard to say to others. She often says something that means in its bare bones that she only loves three people, me, my mother, and my aunt. My Shanghainese is mostly confined to the domestic monosyllabism of childhood. Asking whether she has eaten or what to watch on TV, telling her that I love her. When asked by friends how my grandmother spends her days, I often feel a bit embarrassed to relay the truth, that she watches a TV show about a dog in a language she can't understand. I feel even more embarrassed that my grandmother and I, even though we live together and talk every day, are unable to hold a moderately complex conversation. In April 2020, early in the pandemic, my grandmother contracted COVID-19. She had to go to the hospital alone. They had no translator for her to tell her what was happening and where she was going. They wrote her name down wrong in the computer, that classic mix-up of Chinese last name and first name, which meant she was not searchable for many hours. When I finally got her on the hospital phone, I could not properly tell her how long or why she had to be there. I did not know how to say trust, which broke my heart. COVID was a new disease, and I did not know how to explain it in Chinese either. Eventually, one doctor who spoke Chinese told her she had a disease in her lungs. Her symptoms were mild, and we didn't want to worry her. We were lucky, and she recovered. People born now in mainland China increasingly do not speak their regional language. In her old age and her more solitary life, my grandmother has slipped more and more into Shanghainese. Her Chinese is peppered with, she is forgetting her original Shandong dialect. I am learning standard Chinese, but when I practice with her, she often doesn't understand. In a way, this means the two of us, with our inability to communicate in more common tongues, have a whole language that we use mostly to speak to each other. The category of things we both understand, our TV shows, our overlapping Shanghainese, is narrow but deep. A few years ago, we took in a dog, a foster greyhound with a sweet disposition. My grandmother loved him. She would often greet him and me with a full-mouthed pantomime frown and tell me almost instantly, before saying hello or anything else, that the dog was hungry and that I should feed him. This would happen, of course, regardless of when he had last eaten. I was surprised to be hit with this full-bore cannon of doting and guilt, a treatment I thought she reserved for my mother, not me. my grandmother spoke to the dog in Shanghainese. She told him, looking directly into his brown eyes, that she loved him. And as we scuttled around the house, trying to open doors without letting the dog out, we got to say our phrase, Gutze Leli, for real this time. Letters from Nepal. Consider the vulture. We think of scavengers as gross, but they clean up nature's messes and they need saving. By Meera Subramanian, January 31st, 2024. For nearly 20 years, Yam Bahadur Nepali has been known as the vulture chef of Jatayu Restaurant. Every week, Nepali, a strong and stocky 41-year-old, hitches animal carcasses to a truck and drags them into the clearing of Chitwan National Park in the lowlands of Nepal. Then hundreds of vultures gather for a feast. A group of feeding vultures, which is known as a wake, can transform a hulking carcass into a bare skeleton in the time it takes a human to fix a pot of rice. Nepali began feeding vultures because the birds were dying from what they scavenged themselves. When he was growing up, Nepal was home to more than 1 million vultures, and neighboring India was home to millions more, according to estimates. There was a crucial link in the food chain, responsible for cleaning up nature's messes. Starting in the 1990s, however, farmers began to medicate their livestock with drugs that were toxic to vultures. In less than 2 decades, the populations of 3 common vulture species from the genus Gyps, G-Y-P-S, declined by 97% to 99%. Nepali, whose work is funded by a group called Bird Conservation Nepal, BCN, now spends much of its time scouting for meat that he knows will be safe. Cows that died naturally, spotted deer killed by cars, rhinoceroses whose horns have been poached. He's doing a very important, brave job. Very few people can do that, a conservationist in Nepal told me. Today, after relentless efforts, the country fosters a fragile but growing population of about 20,000. Last spring, scientists from the UK and across South Asia converged on Nawalpur, the district where the restaurant is situated. At BCN, prepared for an historic event, Nepal has been breeding vultures in captivity for years, and in 2017, conservationists finally deemed the area safe enough to start releasing birds. Now it was time for the program's last 10 captives to be set free. Before this final release, the scientists would tag the birds with location trackers. They would also tag 10 wild vultures and compare their fates. Nepali was responsible for luring the wild vultures into a trap. On a day in early March that was hazy from distant wildfires, he dragged a cow carcass, skinned but for its head, into a chain-link aviary the size of an industrial building. For a couple of days, the freed birds gathered on the other side of the fence and gazed longingly at the inaccessible meat. Then, as a cool and foggy Sunday, Nepali, wearing flip-flops and a messy ponytail, slid the gate open. Dozens of vultures rushed in. 2 men who were hiding in the bushes yanked a rope that closed the gate, trapping the wild vultures inside. Then the field exploded into action. A pickup truck drove up, laden with long poled nets, boxes of supplies, and a wooden work table. More than a dozen men arrived on foot and motorbikes, looking like an avian SWAT team, and donned disposable jumpsuits and surgical masks. They slipped into the aviary as Nepali pulled the carcass out, a perfect bait and switch. Chaos followed. The vultures flapped wings that were wider than the men were tall. Some collided with the sides of the aviary. Others tried to grab the fence with their blunt black talons. The men swung nets over white-rumped vultures and gently nudged them into tall wooden boxes. As dust and feathers settled, Nepali opened the gate and ushered the remaining wild vultures out. For the rest of the morning, biologists carefully prodded, measured, and weighed each bird while avoiding their immense dinosaur feet. They affixed bright red aluminum ID rings to their legs, number 85, N86, and so on. I watched Ankit Balish Joshi, a lithe young man who manages the BCN's Vulture Conservation Program, place a solar-charged GPS transmitter between a bird's shoulder blades and fasten a Teflon ribbon around the wings to hold it in place. It looked like a tiny backpack. Then he fluffed the bird's long feathers so that nothing showed except for the solar panel. Each time the scientists finished tagging a vulture, they released it into the wild. Later, Nepali and I stood together in front of the aviary, watching about 50 wild vultures peck at the skeletal remains of the carcass. Many more perched in trees or circled overhead, casting shadows that would make one instinctively cower. We were a microcosm of abundance and a landscape of loss. Most of the 9 vulture species found in South Asia were there in front of us. We watched wild-rumped vultures whose neck ruffles looked like 17th-century formal wear and Himalayan griffins, which are larger and paler. We also saw an immense cinereous vulture, a red-headed vulture with fuchsia wattles, and a small Egyptian vulture. According to the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species, there are less than 1,000 mature individuals left in the world. As recently as the 1980s, South Asian vultures were too numerous to count. In one photograph from that period, hundreds of vultures crowd a New Delhi dump and perch like gargoyles on the buildings that surround it. For thousands of years, Parsi communities, first in Persia and later in India, placed their deceased on squat stone sculptures called Towers of Silence in a practice known as sky burial. Historically, in places like Mumbai, vultures disposed of the bodies, but in the 1990s, the vultures stopped showing up. In 2004, biologists in India started a captive breeding program. Nepal and India banned the veterinary use of diclofenac in 2006, and Nepal created its own breeding program 2 years later. By 2011, conservationists who are working across international borders to breed birds and contain diclofenac formalized into a consortium known as SAVE and held the first of many meetings. They envisioned the breeding centers as temporary arks waiting for the waters of diclofenac to recede. Thakuri told me that when he arrived at C5's location, he scoured the trees and forest floor searching for the spot where the signal came from. Telling me the story, he paused and then smiled. When I reached there, I saw that it was a nest, he said. C5 had stopped moving because she had paired with a wild vulture. That year, C5 successfully raised a chick. The next year, she did the same. There in the trees were a dozen pairs of healthy vultures, busy making more of their kind. That's all the time we have to read on today's broadcast. We have been reading together 90 Years with Dogs by Dorothy M. Norris. Remember, you can hear this and other audio reader programs on the web at reader.ku.edu/digital-archive. My name is Pam Bloom. Thank you for joining me.